This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The bulk of the protesting at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee came on Monday when a variety of organizations united as the Coalition to March on the RNC.
That march was the main organized protest at the convention. The rest of the week has been more subdued in downtown Milwaukee.
Producer Lauren Cox talked to the protesters who are sticking it out all week around the security perimeter, trying to get their message across to attendees of the RNC and whoever will listen.
More than 1,000 protesters marched on the first day of the convention, but by Wednesday, the designated protest zones and speakers' platforms were mostly quiet. Chris Jeske was one of just a few protesters standing at a windy Red Arrow Park yesterday afternoon with a sign that read, "Free Gaza." His organization, Code Pink, marched in the coalition on Monday and is sticking around this week after most other groups left.
The march was always planned as a one-day event and gathering, and especially with a lot of folks coming in from out of town. There's definitely financial constraints.
Jeske and Code Pink are protesting to end war and get money out of politics. That message aligned with many of the other protest groups that came to Milwaukee this week to send a more unified message.
I thought it was a great coming together and showing that there's a lot of people in this country who do not agree with a lot of the agendas and policies put forth by the Republican Party and the platform at this convention.
His protest is not solely targeted at the hosts of the convention, though. Focusing more on the issues than the politicians helped Jeske de-escalate tensions when his activism faced opposition.
There was one gentleman who came up, who's actually in one of the videos that was posted together, who asked, are you just here protesting Republicans? And we said, no, we're here protesting the issues. We're not here to protest people or parties. And the guy seemed to be fine that we were protesting some stances that the Republican Party has taken, as long as we're willing to criticize the Democratic Party at the same time.
Ultimately, the protesting outside of the RNC remained mostly peaceful and productive. Jeske knows that a lot of his audience won't agree with his stances, but he tried to find some kind of common ground with those who engaged him.
I just spoke to another gentleman. It's unclear to me what his political standings are. He seemed very knowledgeable about a few different issues, and he shared some information with me. I shared some information with him. There are definitely some points of confluence that we agreed on.
Code Pink is planning additional demonstrations as the convention wraps up today. One of their members was arrested on Tuesday after Wisconsin Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden accused her of assault. The organization denied that the assault occurred and said it was Van Orden who tried to push past the protester. Lauren Cox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Meanwhile, producer Mackenzie Crummie was indoors at Convention Fest, where souvenir sellers and food vendors were lined up.
There she met Robert Brox, a Milwaukee native working with Gray Jet Cafe. They talked about how business was going and what was on the menu.
We're selling our vegan options of brisket, which is mainly based with jackfruit. And we also have our sweet chicken.
How have things been going? We're almost towards the end of the convention.
We're halfway through it, and it's been kind of slow, but steady. Slow and steady. We're used to vending at large events, maybe 18 to 23,000 people. But then, to hear that, over 50,000 people were to influx into one specific area, you would, think that, it'd be a lot more hustle and bustle.
Are you going to at least break even?
As of right now, no. But if we're anticipating that it picks up.
Do you consider yourself political?
Not necessarily. And this is not on along with Gray Jet, just me personally. I'm kind of in the middle. I've not really made my choice yet. Traditionally, I've been Democratic, but they're kind of dropping the ball now. With the black community, specifically back on businesses, and also just in general. It's just we've been led astray.
As the fourth and final day of the RNC kicks off, we're getting a live update and a preview of closing night.
WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk is with us now with the latest from Milwaukee's Pfizer Forum. Anya, hi. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning.
Good morning. So talk about the tone, the energy in Pfizer Forum. What does it feel like?
Yeah, inside the forum where the actual convention is going on, people are just kind of continuously amped. It's been this really kind of crowded, buzzing, excited energy, especially, you know, as the night goes on, the more kind of high profile figures take the podium, and people are just really excited. People seem really fired up. I think, you know, urgency is a pretty good word for it, a sense that this Republican Party, really shaped by and around former President Donald Trump, has this huge moment to really assert its values in a huge way. And so people are really pretty fired up.
You use the word urgency there. And, you know, in speech after speech, you know, there's also the speech by former Governor Tommy Thompson, who made this impression that it was fiery, raising his voice. What was Thompson trying to convey so passionately and urgently to convention goers?
Yeah, that was one of the more fiery moments, I will say, that I have witnessed. There's this, you know, theme of fighting. People frequently will break out into chants of fight, fight, fight. And Governor Thompson did that as well. But I will say that that sense of impassioned, sort of fiery rhetoric, it's a little bit more subdued after, I think, what happened last weekend, where people are now a little bit more almost kind of joyful and excited. So there's this theme of, for example, making America wealthy and powerful, structured around certain, you know, policy ideas like emphasizing American manufacturing and cracking down on immigration, a lot of focus on social issues, gender and family structure. And so there's a real kind of emphasis on a major almost cultural shift as well. And people just seem honestly as though they think that they will win in November. There's a real sense of almost a foregone conclusion here. That's a lot of real excitement, as I mentioned.
And Anya, a one-of-a-kind potential shifting moment is when the Teamsters president, Sean O'Brien, takes the podium. And you've been reporting on the significance of a union member addressing the Republican Party. What was the core message of O'Brien's speech?
Yeah, that was a pretty historic moment on Monday night. O'Brien did not endorse Trump, but it was the first time that a Teamsters leader has ever spoken at the RNC. And he was essentially there to say that all politicians need to support unions if they say that they support working people. So he called for bipartisan support for union priorities. You know, for the last many decades, unions have typically endorsed Democrats, and the first Trump administration was criticized for things by unions, for things like installing anti-union heads of certain agencies. But O'Brien said that Republicans have been less anti-union in recent years, and that there's this, you know, opportunity for everyone to support workers and especially union workers.
And you talked with Peter Rickman, the president of the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization. And Rickman told you that hundreds of unionized service workers are staffing the RNC on any given day. And you asked Rickman about whether the speech by the Teamsters president means Republicans are stronger on union issues.
I didn't find it to be particularly illuminating. I found it to be pretty frustrating that our members and working people across the country in unions had to sit there and watch this guy, you know, basically muddy the water when it comes to the political choice in front of working people this November.
Does that reaction reflect what other Wisconsin union leaders are saying at this point?
Yeah, I spoke with local and state union leaders, and they were pretty universally frustrated with O'Brien's appearance for exactly what we just heard Rickman describe. They say essentially, you know, the Biden administration has given workers a lot. The Trump administration was anti-union, and that this will confuse voters about that fact because it looks like a Teamster endorsement of the Trump ticket.
And you reported on Ohio Senator J.D. Vance taking the vice presidential ticket as the former President Trump's running mate. How have Wisconsin's RNC delegates reacted to the formalized Republican ticket?
every single delegate that I spoke to is very excited. I think, you know, he's already a bit of a name because of his best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy. He's young, he's a veteran, which really speaks to certain folks in the crowd. And a lot of people I spoke to also said they think he'll make a great president. Trump is running for one additional four-year term. And so his supporters seem to really be eyeing the possibility of that lineage and the prospect of kind of having those MAGA values and policies in place for much longer, potentially for 12 years.
Vance last night really leaning into his personal story, his family roots in the Midwestern state of Ohio. Do you think that that impact of having this Midwestern vice presidential candidate will have an impact on, swing state voters here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think this race is really coming down to, from the strategists I speak to, et cetera, to Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in terms of kind of the big battlegrounds. And so when I spoke to Wisconsin GOP chair Brian Schimming, he told me he thinks that Vance can really specifically speak to those voters, and that's going to be really critical. And so Schimming told me, you know, Vance is welcome in Wisconsin anytime he wants, and he expects him to be coming through here quite a bit.
What else stands out to you among Wisconsin's 41 delegates? What are some of the things that they've talked about?
Yeah, again, I really want to emphasize this sense in the room, and this is perhaps a little bit of confirmation bias of when you get 50,000 of the most faithful party members into a space. But there really is this great excitement over the potential of November. It really seems as though they are expecting, you know, a bit of a rout. And then the other theme, and I touched on, you know, the events of this week, and of course, that's the assassination attempt on former President Trump, that has been such a huge theme, not in a sense of sort of anxiety or fear or heightened security even, but really almost in a motivating force. We're seeing people bandaging their ear sort of as either a fashion statement or a statement of solidarity with Trump. So that has really, I think, also been this hugely galvanizing moment, and perhaps also an opportunity for a tone shift. We are looking to see what that speech is going to be like tonight.
Well, Anya, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's state capitol reporter.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling could have a big impact on regulations in Wisconsin and around the nation.
So this impacts everything from taxation to environmental protection to labor and employment to commerce.
Find out more coming up here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Near the end of its latest session, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the 1984 precedent known as Chevron deference.
That new decision effectively weakens federal regulators and shifts some power from agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency to the courts and Congress.
That is at the federal level. Here in Wisconsin, the power of state agencies has been eroding for more than a decade. That's according to our next guest, who's been following the trends here in the state.
Dave Strifling is the director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. Dave, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
Before we get into the details here, Dave, this may sound a little technical and wonky to people, but there is a lot at stake. What kind of real-world impact can something like this Chevron ruling have, and these questions about administrative decision-making?
So this impacts everything from taxation to environmental protection to labor and employment to commerce. Anything that federal agencies have a hand in regulating is going to be affected by this decision.
Okay, let's check out the decision now. It's been a long time coming, it sounds like. What happened in the Supreme Court decision on what people call Chevron deference? What does it mean?
Sure. So what this all has to do with is, before this decision, federal courts gave deference to federal agency interpretations of terms in statutes. So let's use an example to make it a little bit more digestible. So the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, is charged with interpreting the Clean Water Act. And of course, Congress wasn't clear in everything that it said in the Clean Water Act. Some terms are ambiguous in the statute, like waters of the United States is one that we talk about a lot. So EPA has a legal department and a whole bunch of lawyers, and it had come to a certain interpretation about what some of those terms mean. And when that interpretation gets challenged in court, the Chevron doctrine said if the term was unclear and the agency interpretation was reasonable, courts had to defer to that interpretation. They could not substitute their own judgment for the agency's determination of what those ambiguous terms meant. What this new decision does is undo all that and say that is really the province of the courts to interpret those ambiguous terms. And while an agency's interpretation is entitled to some respect and consideration from courts, courts no longer have to defer to the agency's interpretation, and they can substitute their own judgment if they think there's a better one.
The read on this that I've been seeing is that means that regulations will be harder to define and enforce for agencies like the EPA and others. It ultimately, this could have a deregulatory impact. Is that about right?
I think there's no question that this is going to have a deregulatory impact. I certainly agree as far as that goes. There's a lot of ground to be covered yet on exactly how severe and deep and wide ranging that impact is going to be. The court did leave in place an older case called Skidmore deference. And without getting too far into the weeds about what is entailed in that, I do foresee a future in which courts could still defer to some degree to agencies and their judgments. It's not going to be as significant as a Chevron deference was, but I'm not convinced yet that this is a catastrophe for federal agencies yet either. The lower courts are going to have to sort a lot of these impacts out.
Those lower courts, I'm guessing, are going to be busy after this ruling. Are there, do you imagine, a lot of, say, business groups or businesses waiting in the wings with their eyes on a particular regulation that had an interpretation that they didn't like, and they say, aha, now courts don't have to defer. Now's the time for us to take this to court.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And, you know, one thing I that always bugs me a little bit about this is that you know, some folks seem to think that this decision is something that Republicans, conservatives, business groups have been clamoring for a long time. And to some degree, that's true. And they tend to think this is a political issue. And really, that's, in my view, not the right way to look at this. That, you know, if President Trump should succeed in his election bid, Democrats might be very happy not to have courts defer to interpretations that the Trump EPA might reach. On the other hand, if President Biden succeeds in his reelection bid, Democrats might want the Chevron deference still in place, and Republicans would be the ones not wanting to see courts defer to agency interpretation. So, you know, these shoes can shift at different times and different places, and really, this conversation should be about, you know, who do we really trust to make these kind of decisions? Is it courts who are certainly very intelligent people, but generalists? Or is it agencies who are at least supposedly experts in these particular subject matter interests, interest areas? That's really what this conversation should be about.
Yeah, and taking the partisanship aside, there's a really interesting conversation about separation of powers here. As it stood, the executive branch via these agencies had this power to interpret, as you said, ambiguous clauses that would be provided in laws passed by Congress. And the deference meant that the courts took a less of a heavy hand. Does this tilt the balance of power toward the courts in a significant way?
Absolutely. I think there's no question about that. This is part of a trend we've seen from this United States Supreme Court at deregulation and weakening the power of federal agencies. I don't think there's any question about that.
Now, let's turn to Wisconsin. You wrote, I found this back in 2017, you wrote about this issue, you know, when is the U.S. Supreme Court going to do this? Well, and you pointed out this is already kind of happening in Wisconsin. Take us back to the last, decade and a half, and what is happening, what has been happening in Wisconsin that kind of foreshadowed this at the federal level?
Yeah, absolutely. So the states take all sorts of different approaches to this, as you can imagine. Wisconsin has been one of those that sort of preempted this federal trend, and we've seen this happening in Wisconsin, as you said, for quite a bit of time. A fundamental shift in power away from state agencies, rather, and towards the state legislature, and to a lesser extent, the state courts and the state executive branch. And this takes a lot of different forms, and we can talk about several of them. One is that in a 2018 case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ended the practice of deferring of state courts deferring to the legal interpretations of state agencies. So in that sense, this new decision at the federal level overruling Chevron brings the federal courts in line with Wisconsin courts. In other words, Wisconsin courts already do not defer to the legal interpretations of state agencies. So this isn't going to change that part of things at all, given that Wisconsin courts already have not been deferring to state agencies. But there are many other examples, too, in which the legislature, for example, has taken power from state agencies. And that's part of the reason it's been so difficult to pass PFAS standards, for example, in groundwater. The DNR does not believe it has the authority to move forward with that without specific authorization from the state legislature. Due to the potential cost. So that's one of the reasons, maybe the primary reason, that we don't have yet PFAS standards for groundwater in Wisconsin. So yeah, this is a trend that I've been following for a while now. I think Wisconsin has been, for better or for worse, depending on your perspective, ahead of the curve when it comes to taking power away from executive branch agencies and transferring it to the courts or to the legislature.
PFAS is a high-profile example. Are there other avenues in law, other important issues where this this lack of deference to state agencies has done things that people might see, again, for better or worse, in their daily lives or their businesses?
Yeah, so another one, we started off talking about the Clean Water Act and EPA's interpretation of the term waters of the United States. Well, one of the things this does, this decision, is certainly decreases the power of the federal government agency, the EPA, to interpret when, for example, one needs a permit to discharge fill soil into a wetland. And so less wetlands are going to be regulated probably under this type of approach at the federal level than otherwise would be the case. And so what that does is push that issue down to the states and leave the states free to decide whether they want to, excuse me, for example, regulate discharges into certain types of wetlands, whether that means wetlands of a certain size or wetlands that have a certain type of connection to navigable waters. So, you know, for a long time, Wisconsin had been a state where you needed a permit for almost any discharge into any wetland. The state legislature changed that in about 2017 or 2018, around that same time frame we've been talking about, and exempted certain wetlands below a certain acreage from requiring a state permit. So that's another example of how this decision has concrete impacts on people in Wisconsin, you know, and makes it such that, well, if you don't need a federal permit to do this, you might not need any permit at all if there's no state permit required. There are lots of areas like that. Again, it's a conversation not just about environmental protection, but across the map of things that agencies have a hand in, from labor to commerce to environment to everything in between.
We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on what's called Chevron deference, what it means for federal regulators, and why Wisconsin, our guest says, was ahead of the curve in some ways, for better or worse, in making these kind of changes. Dave Strifling is with us, director of the Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, in 2017, we had that Rains Act passed in Wisconsin, regulations from the executive in need of scrutiny. I understand in Congress there's an effort to pass a similar law. Can you talk about these kind of state and potential federal laws that limit executive power, executive branch abilities to interpret laws passed by Congress.
Yeah, so again, this is all part of that trend against so-called overreach by bureaucrats, to use the term often employed by those who favor these kinds of measures, to take power away from agencies and turn it back to the courts or to the legislature. And so a couple of the forms that that has taken in Wisconsin include, as we've been talking about, the requirement for legislative authorization if a regulation has a certain amount of projected cost impact over a two-year period, or the authority of the legislature to pause rulemaking or to approve an agency's scope statement. Turning to the courts for a moment, not to defer to an agency's legal interpretation. So, you know, again, this is a reaction to the perception that agencies have too much power, whether you're talking about federal agencies or state agencies. And Wisconsin has gone deeper and farther than most states have in terms of reducing that authority that agencies have, and sort of tying the hands of agencies in some ways to do what they want to do without authorization from, say, the legislature, or without really testing that interpretation in front of the courts. And again, I don't express a position on whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a trend that's happening, certainly at the state level and also now at the federal level.
One interesting case here is what I've heard referred to as emerging pollutants, right? So our legislature or Congress passes a law saying, hey, you can't put pollutants into here. Then some years later, the DNR or the EPA, if it's a federal thing, says, well, we've got this new pollutant we didn't know about when that law was passed. We're going to regulate it. But then you could challenge it saying, hang on, that pollutant wasn't covered. It wasn't understood to be a pollutant when that law passed. Law doesn't apply there. Is that some of the argument we can have over these kind of interpretations?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are all kinds of terms like this in statutes that aren't clear on their face. And part of that is understandable, you know, that Congress or the Wisconsin legislature could not have spelled out every individual case that could ever come up under the statute. You know, we don't even know. We probably had never heard of some the emerging contaminants that we're trying to regulate now. And so in the past, courts had handled that by saying, well, we understand that the agencies are the experts. We're going to give them some latitude to handle these kinds of questions. And that seems to have fallen by the wayside a little bit with this decision. And again, we're already seeing some of these impacts in Wisconsin under, for example, the spills law. You know, and there the term is hazardous materials or hazardous substances that are discharged into the environment. Well, what does that mean? Does DNR have the authority to add, say, PFAS to that list? We've got litigation ongoing right now over whether the agency does have the ability to do that. So, you know, this is, again, a weakening of the agency's power to interpret those sorts of ambiguous terms and kind of make policy and make regulations that deal with those situations. They're going to need either the legislature or, in some cases, the courts to bless those interpretations before they can really move forward.
A different kind of case I have in mind, I'm wondering if this fits the bill, ballot drop boxes in Wisconsin, right? So we've got this election agency empowered by the legislature to interpret the law and apply it and help county, you know, local election officials interpret that law. Drop boxes were around for years. I got used more during COVID. They get challenged ultimately saying, hey, wait a minute, the law doesn't specifically say we can have these drop boxes. But the law also didn't say we couldn't have the drop boxes. One Supreme Court decision says, nope, you can't have them. We changed the Supreme Court a little. Now they say, as of last week, yes, you can have them. Is this a case where we're arguing about, hey, how much power does this this agency have to interpret statute?
Yeah, now I've got to say I'm no expert on voting law, that's for sure. But this does seem like a case where there are differing interpretations that an agency has with respect to a statute. And, you know, whether the courts are going to defer to that interpretation is what's in play here. Now, if that's a case where the court is just sort of changing its interpretation, its own interpretation of what the statute means, then that's a little bit different. But You know, this has to do with what the agency says the law means and whether courts are sort of bound to accept that or not.
All right. I started, Dave, by asking you to put this in real world context and not wonky. I want to go in exactly the opposite direction now and talk about kind of our philosophy of how we do government here, how much we empower these executive branch agencies, federal level, state level, to interpret law versus how much we rein them in. I don't know. What do you think about how this says about how we run our government?
Yeah, this is really a tough one. I mean, this is a conversation about whether we see the agency decision makers as sort of scientists in white coats that are experts in the area and are kind of nonpartisan. And, you know, they are the ones that we really trust to make these decisions, and we should defer to what they think. And that's one view. The other view is, you know, agencies are just sort of partisan bureaucrats who are making political decisions, and there's no reason for the courts to defer to them. In fact, it would be unconstitutional for the courts to do so. That's their responsibility to say what the law is. And, you know, to say that either one of those models, either one of those ends of the spectrum is totally correct, obviously blurs a lot of the gray area in the middle. That's probably where the truth of the matter is. So it's hard to say that, you know, either model is preferable.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
That's Dave Strifling, director of the Water, Law, and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, two Wisconsin women take their grilling skills to a TV Pitmaster competition.
It's an opportunity for me to take kind of barbecue and Wisconsin food and what that means into the future and into some territory we haven't explored yet.
Wisconsin takes on a barbecue brawl coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. Two Wisconsin chefs are competing on the new season of Food Network's Barbecue Brawl.
The show brings in pitmasters from all over the country to compete in teams led by celebrity chefs. And this season, the team captains are Bobby Flay, Sonny Anderson, and Michael Voltaggio.
Each week, teams are given grilling-themed challenges like surf and turf or roadside barbecue. The team that scores lowest with the judges has to send a team member home.
The season premiered last week and introduced the country to two women chefs from Wisconsin who are masters of the grill.
Elena Terry is the executive chef and founder of Wild Berries, and Ashley Turner is executive chef for the Milwaukee County Zoo. We caught up with both of them earlier this week, just before episode 2 was about to air. Elena, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Ashley, thanks for being with us.
I'm super excited to be here. Thank you.
All right, let's start with your first challenge on barbecue brawl. In the first episode, they asked everybody to make some sliders. Chef Ashley, you really brought some Wisconsin to this one. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, I kind of tried to find a middle ground between like our two flavor profiles and kind of worlds of food colliding, right? So I used a beer brat as our base and cheese curds melted over the top, and then did a poblano jalapeno bacon relish and bacon aioli.
And Elena, you tackled a surf and turf challenge with a cedar smoked fish. What was it like making that first big dish for the judges?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, let's say that you have a Wisconsinite tackling tilefish. I didn't even know what tilefish looked like when I first ran over to grab it. So the whole experience, I was like, I'm going to do this. I know how to cook fish. I know flavor profiles. So I'm not going to be intimidated by this. Like, bring it on. I came to brawl. So it was a little bit comical at first because I did grab a grouper, and until I was able to figure out what tilefish looked like, it was a little bumpy, but I found my stride. And I mean, from Wisconsin, how could I not do a cedar planked fish?
Now, you've both mentioned having respect for the celebrity chef captains, Bobby Flay, Sonny Anderson, Michael Voltaggio. What was it like, Ashley, to meet them in person?
Do you know, I was actually really surprised at like, they're all like extremely great high level professionals, but then they're also super caring people and really seem to be invested in both the workings of the show, but then also I think in their teams behind them too. Bobby Flay was really helpful for me and kind of just pulling through the anxiety and stress of the situation. And then I know Elena has had just a great rapport and respect for Michael Voltaggio, and Sunny could not be any better a cheerleader. She really is on board for her people, and it was really, really fun to work with them.
And Elena, can you talk about those food stars working with them in person?
I think that on episode one, you could see my face and how just I was so excited to meet them and to be in that space. I think I took a second during the slider challenge and just was like, wow, you're here doing this. Like, you better step up and get to it. That's Michael Voltaggio that just came to talk to you about your food. And it was pretty surreal because, you know, I think I've mentioned it before. I mean, being from Wisconsin, it already, you're not considered a Midwestern stigma that you have to face. So being in that space with these titans in the industry, like literal titans, it was amazing, and it took me a minute to process it.
We're talking with two chefs who represented Wisconsin on the show Barbecue Brawl, Chef Elena Terry, executive chef and founder of Wild Berries, and Ashley Turner, executive chef for the Milwaukee County Zoo. All right, let's talk Wisconsin here. Ashley, Elena just mentioned Wisconsin maybe not coming in with a lot of respect from the barbecue world. What was it like to represent the state down there?
For me, I get the opportunity and the gift of being kind of an ambassador for two places that really have their own point of view, Wisconsin and then West Texas being the other. And I've really enjoyed kind of sharing the West Texas with Wisconsin and then, you know, developing Wisconsin-centered items myself here. So I love it. And I think this place is so cool. I love Wisconsin a ton. So I was happy to be able to be doing this kind of for both.
And Elena, I've talked to you over the years about, you know, summer produce and berries, and I didn't know open fire is kind of your thing. And you're also a butcher and a wild game specialist. Talk about that part of your cooking.
Yes. I mean, that's where my roots started, right? It was around an open fire with my grandmothers and my family, doing traditional things. And that's where my love for cooking began, in the space that I associate with really feeling cared for and having family. So being able to fast forward to today, where I have worked in corporate barbecue restaurants, but never really felt that space as being a live fire expert or saying that I was a wild game specialist until I really took a step it and really, I guess, categorized my accomplishments and was able to say, I am capable of doing all of these things. And what a beautiful way for me to do that than to really honor these practices that were taught to me at a very young age. And I feel the privilege of that and the responsibility of representing for Wisconsin.
Now, Ashley, you've come from the restaurant world and elsewhere. Now you're the executive chef at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Can you talk about that role and what it means?
Yeah, you know, I have been building small businesses and I'm working in locally owned restaurants, both here and in Texas, for myself and for other folks. And it's a different animal, literally. Literally a different animal here at the zoo, which I actually started after we filmed Barbecue Brawl. So I went from brawling to zoo life, and it's been an awesome adventure. I really like can't say enough about the park and the people and the conservation efforts that happen here. And not only that, like, they've, with my coming on board, we had a real interest in, you know,
bringing a focus back to scratch cooking in all of the units, and really showing up with some things that are unique. So it couldn't be more of a treat, really, to get to be here among a lot of people and in a space that Milwaukee and Wisconsin values so highly, and rightly so. It's beautiful.
And Ashley, I want to stay at the zoo for a moment, and maybe the food has changed. I remember when my kids were little, and this is a while back, I said one of my most memorable lines as a parent, you can't have any ice cream until you have more of your pizza and fries. Not
right.
A proud moment for me. Are you changing the food, or has the food changed at the zoo?
I mean, so, you know, the things that are staples, and they're kid friendly for a reason. We're still doing burgers. We're still doing fries. We're still doing chicken tenders. But then we're also, like, we've brought in, braised and pulled ham paninis in one of our locations. We're doing organic turkey and fried green tomatoes and pimento cheese, jalapeno relish. Like, so yeah, those are not ingredients that I think had previously been represented here on the zoo grounds, but we're excited to play with those and to give kind of play to the hits, right? We've got the standards that people have come to expect and some things that maybe they haven't tried before. Finding how to kind of thread that needle has been fun. And we also have a la carte coming up in August, and that's going to be a fun opportunity for the zoo and also for myself, because we're going to be doing barbecue here during that event. Ooh. And I'll have the smoker out and we'll get this thing going.
Elena, you're the executive chef and founder of Wild Berries, as I've mentioned. Tell us some about the work you do there.
Sure. So right now we're in the middle of our growing season. We have a lot of community outreach happening in these gardening spaces. And one of the things that we do with our organization is seed save and work on ancestral and traditional food ways, bringing those back to our community. We also have a culinary mentorship program, which has serviced over, I believe it's 325 indigenous chefs across the Americas. So we have different hubs in different states, but all of the work really is to bring focus to Native American food sovereignty, food security, traditional practices, and a better sense of what our community really is. So we really appreciate the space that we have in our greater community and being able to provide things like catering services or educational outreach to have them feel included in the work that's being done. It really is an incredible journey that I'm blessed to be on.
And can you talk about handing on some of those traditions that you mentioned when it comes to grilling and wild game, trying to share those now with future generations?
Sure. I mean, what better place to exchange some knowledge and practices than by actually doing it? My family is all coming over tonight to my house so that we can cook out together and have a watch party for this evening's episode. And it's those kinds of things where you open the door and you're able to celebrate or share time in spaces where you have an opportunity to say a traditional teaching or story or lesson or practice. And it's naturally included in what you're doing. So I think the more opportunities we have to share and to spend time with the next generation, to open doors and really acknowledge the energy and the education that we were given by our ancestors. And I think for us as Native people, it has been what these practices are, why we have the knowledge we do today. So this reclamation that we're in this moment, I mean, it's an opportunity for me to be a good ancestor and to share education, to create a space where our next generation feels supported and seen, and to say, if I can do it, we can do it together.
Ashley, you mentioned setting up your smoker at that event coming up in the fall at the zoo. I understand this is a well-traveled smoker. This is one you brought up from Texas?
Yeah, that's true. Have smoker, will travel. And, you know, that's kind of been the philosophy here. We were fortunate to do, Elena and I, a pop-up with some friends over at Amalinda last month, and the ability to even bring pecan wood from Texas up here to smoke with is something that, again, is barbecue's hyper-regional, and so much of that is about flavor profiles that come from wood and what is grown near you. So a lot of times up here, I tend toward using hickory and cherry in some form or combination. But my kind of home flavor profile is pecan wood. So we've been able to kind of have some fun and play with that.
Elena, speaking of kind of regional ideas of barbecue, is there a Wisconsin style, or are there things that you think, you know, are common here in Wisconsin?
I mean, there's definitely things that we're known for in Wisconsin, but I believe that the beauty of the barbecue in Wisconsin is that we aren't defined by parameters or a certain kind of style, that you can have something like a smoked T-bone and a bratwurst on the grill together, and that is Wisconsin. You know, that we have this beauty of diversity and celebration of food that I'm hoping Ashley and I have a chance to really represent on the show this season.
You're not just representing Wisconsin. I think a lot of people might think of the world of grilling and barbecue as being male-dominated. You think pitmaster. People might think a dude. Ashley, could you talk about what it's like to represent women in the pitmaster world?
Do you know, I think that that's extremely special. I mean, right? And it speaks to Wisconsin in general and how willing I feel like the Midwestern population is to just like support us and cheer for us and go with us. Because yeah, absolutely. Like I, you know, a third generation restaurant from Texas, it was vastly and wildly male dominated. And that's just, you know, that hasn't been true for myself, for Elena. I think we've just gone and dug in and, you know, staked our own kind of claim and put our own stamp on this craft. And I'm super proud of that work, and I'm super proud to be able to support her and cheer for her as she pushes forward all of her traditional background. And it's an opportunity for me to do the same and take kind of barbecue and Wisconsin food and what that means into the future and into some territory we haven't explored yet.
And Elena, can you talk about being a woman in the at least previously male-dominated world of grilling and barbecue?
Yeah, it's not too much different from being a woman in the chef world. You know, it's always fighting for space and for earning that space, not having it given to you. So to be on a national level representing as a female chef pitmaster, not only myself, but all of the women who showed up for barbecue brawl, I mean, it shows that we are not only capable, but we can excel in these places. I think part of that male ideology that has been in the forefront is because it is a very physically demanding job to do. You know, running a pit is not something easy, but for me, it's a place of comfort and it's a place I understand. So why would I not want to be there showing the world what we're capable of?
Thank you both so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That was Elena Terry, executive chef and founder of Wild Berries here in Wisconsin, and Ashley Turner, executive chef for the Milwaukee County Zoo. They are both competing in the new season of Food Network's Barbecue Brawl. They are still competing. They made it through episode 2. New episodes air Monday nights. The show is available to watch on the Food Network channel and on HBO Max and Discovery Plus.
Tis that time of year. The Packers training camp kicks off with a practice on Monday morning, and it coincides with the annual shareholders meeting later that day at Lambeau Field.
In coming days, we'll get a season preview from a Packers super fan who's a season ticket holder for nearly a quarter century.
And we want to know from you, are you gearing up for the season? Do you have plans to go to family night, perhaps, to experience that Lambeau atmosphere? And how do you feel about roster changes and Jordan Love's leadership as quarterback?
Share your Packers prospects right now. Leave a message or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today or email WisconsinToday@WPR.org and go Pack.
We Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.